What is charisma and how can somebody like me develop it?
So a lot of people know about IQ. Tell me a little bit about EQ. Do you think your upbringing had something to do with you being an introvert? What gifts or advantages do introverts have over extroverts?
Oh, AJ, thank you for being here, man. Wow. It's an honor to have you. Your story is super interesting. Is it 15 years you've been doing what you've
almost
been doing?
16,
almost 16. You're an expert a few times over in what you do. And what you do, I find very beautiful and needed in this world today. If I can paraphrase what you do, it's you have a podcast and you help people. Not only podcasts, you do boot camps and speaking and coaching and helping people to, I think, live successfully in the world. Helping people with the confidence and connecting relationships, personal, business. And it's amazing work. I think you've been called the Dale Carnegie of the modern world. This is a very apt way to describe what you do. But I want to ask you, but you also have an interesting origin story, right? You started in cancer biology and you landed in podcasting. So tell me, walk me through this transition. How do you go from a very scientifically driven and minded field to more of a human field?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me. I enjoy sweating with you here and happy to share a bit more of my story. So, you know, growing up, I always wanted to be a doctor. And I wanted to impress my family and do well by them. So I graduated from Michigan with a biology degree in undergrad, and I wanted to bolster my academic application to med school. So I took on a research project, and I was doing cancer biology research, and I loved it. It was so hands-on, and it was like direct results and feedback. And then I published a paper, and after publishing the paper, the co-author on the paper, who was my mentor, was like, "Hey, have you ever thought about a PhD instead of an MD?" And I was like, no, you know, I never really thought about that. It wasn't really something that I looked into. And he's like, well, you did such great work on this project. Like, maybe you should apply to grad school. So I listened to him and I applied to grad school. And when I got there, I just realized it wasn't for me. Everyone there I thought was smarter than me. They were more accomplished than me. They published more papers than me. And then I had this real lack of confidence and imposter syndrome came up that I didn't belong, that I wasn't good enough. And all those doubts crept into my mind. And those doubts impacted my dating life too. So I started the podcast as a bit of a personal journey to how to overcome this and how to build friends and how to improve my dating life and how to restore that confidence that I had in undergrad. All my friends had moved all over the country, basically. So I was starting over in grad school, trying to build a social circle too. And as an introvert, I was really struggling in all of those areas. So decided to start the podcast in Ann Arbor, and it just sort of got a little bit of fanfare locally, and then it sort of took off. And out of the podcast,
what year was
this? Journey.
Sorry, what
year? This was in 2008.
It is, okay, wow. Okay, got you. Nice.
So the podcast, like, basically was the springboard to the coaching. It grew an audience, and they started asking us for help. They were having very similar issues in their own lives. And we were interviewing experts in the field, and all of our listeners were like, but I really relate to your story. Like, can you help me personally? Because you seem confident and charismatic on the podcast. And I was still working to grow in these areas. But we offered coaching, and sort of that led to us moving to New York City. And then the podcast was discovered by Sirius XM Radio. And we did a radio show on satellite, helping people grow their confidence in their dating life. And from there, the work has now grown to be working with companies, work with the military, and it's really around emotional intelligence and relationship building.
Okay.
And obviously confidence plays a big role in that.
Your work, you talk about actually not just confidence, but the three C's. Is it confidence, connection, and
charisma?
Charisma. Okay. So your brand is the art of charm. Charisma. What is charisma? And how can somebody like me develop it?
So charisma is that ability to draw people in and become memorable.
Okay.
Right? So when we think of charismatic people, they stand out from the crowd. They're the people we gravitate towards. They're the people we remember after the event. They're the people we want to spend more time with because they make everyone around them feel great. So when we talk about charisma, we're really talking about being present. So that's a mindfulness, that's an understanding and self-awareness. We talk about being enthusiastic. So bringing energy and positivity to the interaction, and then allowing others in conversation to feel good around you. Hmm. You know, so often in conversation, we want to get our point across, or we want to share who we are, and we want other people to be impressed by us. But in actuality, people want to share themselves. So the better you make them feel, the more you get them opening up and sharing about themselves, the more charismatic you actually become.
You also talk about communication. Some law, some rule. Do you recall this?
The formula?
The formula, that's the word. The formula. Yeah. Tell me about the formula.
So many of our clients, myself included, being introverted, you know, struggle with meeting people for the first time and initiating that conversation. And we tend to find that a lot of our clients are super analytical. We like to joke sometimes they're better at talking to computers than humans. So I want to come up with a formula that would allow you to be more effective in those moments where you don't know what to say, where you get in your head, you get a little slightly off, and all of a sudden the conversation starts to die. So the conversation formula really allows you to take interest in the other person, as we said, to grow that charisma, and to relate to them in a way that opens up connection. So the way we do that is we ask a question of the other person. And a question takes interest. But the question can't be a yes or no question, right? So it's like, what do you love about Portugal?
Okay.
You sharing what you love about Portugal is an opportunity for connection. It's an emotional bid. This is based on Dr. John Gottman's work around romantic relationships. But we do this with everyone. We're trying to connect constantly. And we're using these little bids for emotion to connect with others. So you ask the question. You have to listen to their answer. So you sharing what you love about Portugal, well, you're going to think about all the great things. It's going to put you in the mood. You're going to have this great vibe and emotion about you. And in listening to your answer, I want to find a way to relate to you. And that's the third step of the formula is then respond in a statement. So many people in asking that question of like, what do you love about Portugal? You might share it's the food. And they'll say, oh, well, what food do you enjoy? A few questions, you're like, but I don't really know AJ. And I feel put on the spot. I feel like I'm being interviewed. But if I go, oh, when I was in Portugal, I loved the salted cod. You're like, okay, right? It's a statement. So it's not so much pressure on you. We're finding moments of connection through that conversation formula that allows the other person to feel good, but also allows you to be vulnerable and share too.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I see when you're speaking also, you make a lot of hand gestures. And I know you've had a lot of body language experts on your show, and you've spoken to them. Body language is what do they say? 70 to even 90% of all communication. Tell me, what have you learned about body language, and how can someone improve their body language and also try to understand someone else through their body language?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Everything we do in our coaching focuses on nonverbal communication first, followed by verbal communication.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we do that by filming our clients and participants in our coaching programs because you don't really know what your body language is until you see yourself from the outside. So we often say, our clients will say, I smile a lot, or I have open body language and I'm always warm. But in moments of nerves or anxiety, we actually aren't smiling. We're tensing up. And we often will exhibit what we call closed body language, crossing our arms, making ourselves smaller, leaning in. And in that closing of our body language, we're closing our mind to the conversation. And the other person could read that as you're uninterested, you don't feel good, you don't want to be there. And of course, those signals nonverbally will force the other person to like take pause, maybe move away from you, not feel comfortable around you. So when it comes to body language, you want to be open in our body language. And the way we do that is through our eye contact.
Okay.
So we make good eye contact. We smile. We showcase warmth in our face. And we have our shoulders open, our chest open, our arms at our sides. And through that open body language, we're allowing the other person to feel more comfortable around us, which allows them to focus on the words instead of what our body language is saying.
Wow. Okay. So you teach people by showing what they actually look like in action?
Yeah.
Recording. So how does that, oh, so I guess you do like dramatizations or examples of conversation? How does that work? How do you teach somebody?
All of our coaches are strangers to our clients, right? Okay. So you may have heard me on the podcast. You may have heard my business partner and co-host Johnny on the podcast, but we have a team of coaches. Mm. So it's not even a dramatization. We just have a coach there who they haven't met before.
Okay.
And they have to walk up and strike up a conversation. Okay. And in that moment, we're filming them to look at their body language first. Mm. So we'll play back the video first with no audio at all. Mm. And just ask them, how do you feel? What do you see? Huh. How do you feel the coaches reacting and responding? Mm. So by removing the audio, we're training ourselves to like really think about what's going on non-verbally.
Mm.
Then we turn on the audio and we say, okay, was your body language impactful? Was it actually allowing the audio and the words and the verbal communication to stand taller? Mm. Or was it taking away from, was it distracting what you were trying to say and do?
Mm. As we talk about body language, I'm trying to notice my own body language. Am I closed off? I'm kind of sweating. How are you feeling, by the way?
I'm sweating too, yeah.
A little detox.
Yeah.
I know it's all about embodiment. Well, maybe not. I'm talking to the expert here. But from my perspective, it would be about embodying the state first. So do you tell them to come to a state of openness or welcomeness, think about something before they approach the person, or how does it,
so
what's going on mentally?
Yeah, it's actually funny. The mind leads the body and the body leads the mind.
Mm.
So, and there's a lot of great research around this, around meditative practices and body language. So if you think about it, your thoughts, emotions versus your body language, right? Your shoulders, your smile, your eye contact. Which of those two is easier for you to change?
Mm.
Your body language, right? It's a lot harder to overcome sadness. It's a lot harder to overcome self-doubt. So by focusing on your body language, just putting a smile on your face, just making more gentle eye contact with someone, by opening up your chest, you're actually working to change what's going on mentally for you and put your mind in a state of openness, feeling good, and embodying that great emotion. So that's why we focus so heavily on nonverbal communication. Not only do we know it's highly impactful in every interaction we're having, but it also allows us to shift our mind to feel better and allow other people around us to feel better by having that smile, by having that openness.
Mm. This is behavioral activation theory.
Yeah.
I love that because, you know, I study mental health and I know you do too. And You know a lot about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, kind of like the gold standard. And I think everybody should learn about it. It's just, it should come when we're born. We should learn the distortions that we trick ourselves into once we're born, because it would solve a lot of suffering. But you're right. I think the way out of, you know, depressive states is moving, is action. You can't think your way through it. You have to be it. You have to move in the body, like you said. We'll catalyze the mind to shift states.
Absolutely. Mm. So we are huge practitioners of a subset of cognitive behavioral therapy called acceptance commitment therapy.
Mm.
And it's really around centering your life around your core values. Mm. So not external goals, but who do you want to be? What do you really value? What do you really care about? So for me, I really value freedom. That's a core value of mine. And we were talking about my travels and like what I'm trying to do with the company.
Yeah.
It's all around that core value of freedom. How do I unlock more of that freedom and time in my life?
Huh.
So if we think about what you're talking about, right? You have your thoughts that turn into your beliefs, that turn into your actions.
Mm.
Well, it actually starts a step before that, and that's your self story.
Mm.
What is the story that you tell yourself, right? So for me, entering graduate school, the story I was telling myself is, I'm not good enough. I don't belong here.
Mm.
Everyone's better than me.
Wow.
So that story led to thoughts.
Mm.
I failed. I made a mistake.
Wow.
Everyone's looking at me.
Wow.
Led to beliefs of, yeah, I really don't belong here. I shouldn't be here. I gotta leave.
Hmm.
Right? That imposter syndrome.
Hmm.
But what happens is, if we start by changing the behavior, the actions you're taking, you can start to create data points that allow you to rewrite the story.
Yeah.
And when you actually get to authoring your self story through those actions that you're taking, you can start to shift your thoughts and change those beliefs.
Hmm. Proof.
Exactly.
You make proof. You make yourself
you need data,
proof.
Right? The scientists in me. I need data.
I'm a very scientific, empirical person too. And I think, like you, our scientific minds have helped us to gain deep understanding of these principles and be able to share them, right? Break them down. What's the formula? What's the recipe? You've had the opportunity to interview a lot of impressive people Neil deGrasse Tyson, David Goggins, Kobe Bryant. And I wonder, from all the people, how many people have you interviewed so far?
Over 800.
Over 800. Okay. Wow. So you've picked the brains of over 800 people. Tell me, let's go down three categories. Let's go mindset, let's go relationships, and let's go health. So in mindset, what were some of the biggest takeaways from the interviews that you've conducted?
Honestly, and that's the recurring theme, is that action trumps and changes and shifts that mindset piece, okay. Right? So many listeners, followers, and even clients will come to us believing they can think themselves into the action or the person they want to become. Huh. And you have to act as if, right? So with Kobe Bryant talking about, you know, his alter ego, for him, he had to shift his mindset to be the killer, to be Black Mamba when he went on the court. He's a soft, gentle guy outside of the court. But on the court, he took on that villain persona internally to drive himself through mindset to behave as the killer on the court, to knock down those shots, to perform at a high level. So often we get caught up in listening to more content, consuming more, and just focusing on our thoughts. When really we need to be focusing on our actions. What are the smallest steps we could take towards our goal? And those actions, as I said, will shift our belief, our mindset. On the relationship front, it really
Boy, hold on one second. Because you, I mean, this is brilliant. This is amazing stuff. So Kobe, he changed his story, I guess, when he was on the court to this this Black Mamba figure. Did he get into how he did that?
So that alter ego came about by him being villainized in the media, by players disliking the way he showed up to the team to push them in practice. And that alter ego allowed him to start to change his thoughts, to shift those beliefs on the court, right, in that environment. So he was able to drop into that alter ego to perform at a high level.
Okay.
And it's like David Goggins, we talked about him.
Yeah.
Well, he's David.
Yeah.
When he showed up to the interview, he's like soft, he's meek, he's actually quite down to earth and calm and quiet. You wouldn't expect him to be an introvert. And then he has this alter ego, Goggins. That's who you hear on the podcast. That's who you see in the media. But he has to turn that on. He has to shift into that alter egoed state to be so in your face, to be that, to perform at such a high level.
I think what I'm saying is, how does that shift happen? Because I know some people have like a uniform they put on, a cape, a symbol that they wear, a necklace, a hat, and they turn into this other character. Do you practice this at all, or do you have any cool stories of people doing something like that?
So I think when I started, you know, it was a big piece for me. Putting on glasses was sort of my opportunity to shift into that. And you'll see me on, maybe not when I'm sweating this much, on the podcast, wearing glasses.
Okay.
But to your point, exactly, uniforms can do that. Jewelry, wristwatches can be that little icon that clicks your mind into thinking, okay, this is who I want to become. But if we take a step back, right, who is the hero in your story? Right? You have to create your own hero story to start to change those thoughts, to shift those beliefs, to change those actions. So through taking the data from those actions, how can we start to visualize the hero we want to become? Right? What's the journey we're on? And how do we become the hero of our own story?
Okay. Awesome. Let's go relationships.
Okay.
What are some of your biggest takeaways dealing with, let's go romantic, personal relationships?
It really was that concept, as I said earlier, of emotional bits by Dr. John Gottman. This idea that the better listener you are, the more you can recognize emotional bids in conversation. When someone really wants to share, when someone really wants to open up, or maybe when someone really wants to get to know you. And if you can turn, as he says, towards those emotional bids, receive them, respond to them, the other person feels heard, validated, connected to you. And that's a skill set of being an active listener and recognizing emotional bids and turning towards them. And bringing that into your romantic relationships. Well, Dr. Gottman's work is all around how to make relationships last through the test of time. And he found that partners that turn towards each other's emotional bids, they stay married 40, 50 years.
Wow.
Right? So when you think about those romantic relationships, you know, are you turning towards your partner's bids or are you ignoring them? Are you turning away? Are you changing the subject?
And a bid is?
A bid could be something as simple as I come home from this interview and my wife says to me, man, you'll never imagine what my boss said to me today. Right? I could say, hey, boo, what's for dinner? Change the subject, turn away from that bid. Or wait, what did your boss say? What happened? So that's an emotional bid. That's an example of her sharing something with me or wanting to share something with me. Open the door to sharing and vulnerability. And I'm either opening the door to you and walking in or I'm closing the door and changing the subject or making it about me.
And a lot of people, we don't have that awareness. So we close the door on the bids.
Might say, oh, wow, that's crazy. But I just got back from the sauna and I had this amazing, you know, and make it about ourselves.
I did a video on John Gottman. His work is incredible. I mean, he's like the foremost freaking master guru on relationships. What is it? The thing he can predict with like 95% accuracy or something like that within a few minutes of
just
meeting.
Just by watching couples interact. It's powerful stuff.
Small things. Those small emotional bids. That's amazing. Okay, that's a big takeaway. Let's go into health.
So the biggest shift for me around health has been removing alcohol from my life.
Okay.
So I'm a year and a half in to no alcohol. And it, of course, when I started the journey, I thought, how am I going to have fun? How am I going to have friends? What am I going to do? You know, and all those negative thoughts come up, you know, but it's opened my eyes to early mornings, to making time for all of my routines, to not missing the gym, to all the other pieces of health and wellness that I need to do to feel good. Alcohol was draining away from my life.
No alcohol at all.
No alcohol at all.
Not one glass of wine for a holiday, anniversary, just cut it out completely. Okay.
So we used to do dry January, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, and we would typically go till Valentine's Day. And then we'd have a bottle of wine at dinner and then sort of fall back into habits around drinking. And we were getting married and we're like trying to get in shape and look good and feel good. And we were like, let's just take a break from alcohol and see how long we could go. And we hit the year mark and realized it didn't really have a negative impact on our life at all. Our friends are still our friends. We have more time for each other. I'm not ordering DoorDash. I'm not skipping my workout, you know, sleeping in, all those other things that everyone says to do. Wake up early, right? Work out every day. Have time to meditate. Create your morning routine. Well, for me, alcohol was sapping the energy from every single one of those wellness activities that I needed to feel my best.
That was the big domino that needed to fall. Okay. I never got into it. Did your parents drink?
You know, occasionally for like celebratory moments.
Same. Mine weren't big drinkers either. I think it was, I just never liked the taste of it.
Yeah. That's good.
And I don't like, I've been drunk twice. Okay, let's be honest. Let's be vulnerable. Twice. And it's not fun. It's not a fun thing, especially in the morning. Like, it's just, it's poison. I think it's a low vibration. No disrespect to anybody that enjoys it. I know a lot of Blue Zone communities in other countries have a glass of wine a day, the polyphenols. You know, I think LeBron James drinks red wine. You know, if you can do it, do it. If it makes you, you know, feel good, if you're balanced and healthy, I don't see an issue with it. But for you, you felt like it was the thing that needed to be removed for everything else in your life to get better.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it was so woven into my life. It was where I would go for stress relief. It was where I would go to celebrate something. It was how I would end up staying out later than I wanted, how I would end up investing in friendships or relationships that weren't really relationships. They were just someone to drink with, you know? So removing the fog of alcohol from my life created the space I needed to follow all the wellness routines and the goals I had set for myself that were slipping behind by canceling the Barry's boot camp, by eating DoorDash, by staying up late and hitting snooze on the alarm and not getting to the meditation, right? So when I think about cornerstones of health, I think that's an area that, and I'm really excited about younger generations and how they view alcohol. For me, it was a big part of my college experience. And it was how I dealt with social anxiety as an introvert. And I thought I came into a more charismatic or gregarious state that allowed people to like me through consuming alcohol. And that was all just a mirage.
You saw yourself. That's awesome. Okay. How you feeling?
Great.
We're kind of sweating. We're sweating a ton here.
A little damp,
Let's be safe. And hop out. Let's get some hydration,
yeah.
some water, some coconut water, and let's continue the conversation. Amazing. How's that sound?
Oh, man. Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right, let's jump in, man.
Yeah.
So, AJ, when we look at the world, we see, I think, one of the hot topics this year is artificial intelligence. It's AI, you know, ChatGPT, all these things. A lot of people are afraid. A lot of people are excited. A lot of creatives, a lot of artists are, you know, I think probably fearful. Now, when it comes to the things that you teach, these social skills, how do you think AI is going to affect it? I ask that because it seems like the need to become social is less and less. Everything is digital. Everything is email, online, Zoom. And the personal interaction seemingly are becoming less and less. Does that mean this trend will continue or will these skills become more valuable?
The latter. Mm. As we lose these skills, those who can maintain or can grow and have expertise in the human element, emotional intelligence, like we teach our military members, that's mission critical. That's always going to be there because as humans, we do business with each other. Mm. We don't do business with machines. Behind every machine is a human, either looking to profit, looking to unlock something, looking to gain. So machines are a tool. AI is a tool. And those who can grow the skill set to talk to the AI, to get the most value out of the AI, but then also get the most value out of working with other humans, understand yourself and others deeply, motivate, lead, those skills are always going to be in demand. And I would argue higher demand as we move more and more towards a digital less in person world. And when you think about everything in life that we want, there's a negotiation with another person, right? Your spouse, your significant other, buying a home, buying something, like commerce is relationship based. So I would argue now is the time to build relationships. Now is the time to invest in social skills, to invest in communication. Because that is ultimately how you're going to get ahead in an even more competitive world with AI bolstering our productivity.
Are you seeing people jumping at this or do you see less and less?
I see clients come to us when they've reached a point where their skills are no longer useful in their career and they now have to lead and manage other people and their skills, right? So many of my clients focus on getting a great education, becoming proficient, if not expert level in their skills. And then all of a sudden, they're not promoted to manager or they are promoted to manager and working with other people and leading a team. And now they feel that they don't have those skills because they've gone the lone wolf. They've gone internal as the introvert and I just have to keep building myself personally. So I think in general, shifting your view to relationship building and bolstering those skills of listening, being an effective communicator, being charismatic, and problem solving and conflict with other humans, those skills are going to be highly sought after in this digital world that we're in.
Wow. I agree. It's such an interesting phenomenon that's happening. A lot of careers are gonna be shifted, but I do think these human skills, these human qualities will be that much more prized, you know, and valued. I'm curious, you had a video and you said in the video, in conversations, people aren't looking for solutions. Now, I heard that. I was like, what? Why do we have conversations then if we're not looking for solutions? But you say we're actually looking for something else. Tell me about that.
Validation. You know, we're all full of these emotions that we're feeling. We all have this self story that we're telling ourselves and we want to validate it. We want to know that other people understand us, like us, want us in their tribe. So often, and especially for men, being solution oriented in a lot of roles we take at work and being very logical in the way we think, being less in tune with our emotions, we don't really think about validating other people. We want to get the problem solved. We want to get to the solution. We want to alleviate any of the emotion that you might be feeling. So and again, going back to Dr. John Gottman's work, a lot of the fights, a lot of the arguments that we have with our significant other, our partner, revolve around not validating one another, not allowing the other person to feel heard, understood, and loved.
So I often will ask in those situations where I feel that nerve of like, I want to give a solution. I want to coach someone. I want to share. Huh. Are you looking to just vent, or are you actually looking for a solution or what I think may help you? And oftentimes my wife will just say, my friends will just say, hey, I just want to vent. Like, I just want to blow off steam. I just got to get this out of my head. And I want someone else to be present and fully engaged in what I'm saying and sharing.
Now, do you find that you're like that as well? When you're going through something, do you just want to vent, or are you looking for solutions? Because you have the science background.
Yeah.
You're always.
So, you know, as an introvert, I find it more difficult to vent.
Okay.
Like, I want to just keep those emotions internal. I want to stew on them. I want to go on a long hike alone. Like, I want to just throw on a podcast, go on a drive, you know, work it out myself. So I often find that my wife wants to hear my emotions. She wants to hear me vent more than I actually do.
Is she more extroverted?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. I'm very introverted myself, grew up like that. Tell me, what gifts or advantages do introverts have over extroverts?
I definitely feel as an introvert, and Susan Cain has a lot of great work in this area around introverts. I think the special set of skills that introverts bring to the situation is deep thought and ability to really actively listen. And there's some research around exactly how introverts interact in these moments in conversations and what they pick up on and what information they hear. And I know for me personally, because I don't like sharing, because I'm not really someone who's going to be very vocal, I spend most of my time just sitting there and listening and absorbing. You know, I just got back from a ski weekend in Aspen, and there's some new people there I hadn't met in the friend group. And I just found myself just like sitting there and asking myself, like, who is this person? Right? Instead of being like, I do this and I'm from here and I do this and I've done that, which so many extroverts might feel the urge to do, right? Share who they are, share their thoughts and feelings. So as an introvert, just love getting to know people, love hearing their story, hearing who they are. And when I bring that into conversation, when I ask those deeper questions around what people love, what they're motivated by, what they're excited about, I find it leads to better conversation.
Do you think your upbringing had something to do with you being an introvert?
Yeah, I definitely feel that that was a nature and a nurture. Okay. So my family, for the most part, is introverts. So my dad, very introverted, my sister, introverted. So in a house full of introverts, you kind of, you know, we'll sit there in silence eating meals more than having, you know, these loud conversations. And then also, I think for me, a lot of what I wanted to do was in isolation. My dad was a single parent. He was at work. So I was really left to play, you know, on my own. And in a lot of that, I was working on my imagination and coming up with more creative ways to be entertained. So I think that kind of led to me being more introverted.
Yeah, I resonate with that because that's how I grew up too. And thinking about, you phrased it, you said everybody in your family is introverted. And I thinking about mine and yeah, pretty much the same. My dad might be a little more extroverted, but I look at my brothers, pretty much keep to ourselves. But I don't know. I've always, like, my journey has been one of wanting to break through that. We all know the ego is, look at me, look at me. The old Icarus story of him being cautioned not to fly too high. He'll melt his wing. The sun will melt his wings. But in that story, we forget he was also cautioned not to fly too low. And I think there's a, for me, introversion can sometimes turn into shyness and even not being confident with your own gifts. How have you overcome that one?
I think for me, it's been focusing on my curiosity piece. So in my struggle, especially in graduate school and that feeling of imposter syndrome, all of my focus turned internal. And I didn't see other people struggling with it, you know? So I became the victim in my own mind, and it became this impossible task for me to overcome to rebuild my confidence. What I found is by actually being more curious about other people, getting them to share, it took the pressure off me as an introvert. You know, I don't have to fill the room with my energy. I don't have to be the most interesting person in the room. And it gave all these other opportunities for people to really then ask me questions in return,
yeah.
right? Say, mm-hmm. wait, who's AJ? Mm-hmm. Instead of me being forced to have my elevator pitch or be someone I'm not. So that's how I use my introversion to tap into curiosity mm-hmm. as my gift, to get other people to open up on the podcast and conversation, mm-hmm. talking to clients. Mm-hmm. And in turn, find that oftentimes if you take enough interest in someone else, mm-hmm. they become more interested in you.
Yeah.
And then they want to get to know you. And it becomes a lot easier for me conversationally in that manner. Mm.
To be interesting, be interested. I love that. Something a lot of people deal with too is just social anxiety. Is curiosity the way out of that too?
It's certainly the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And a buddy of mine, Andrew Horn, who I've had on the podcast, you know, he likes to think about going into the event curious. Mm. What do I want to know about this person? Mm. You know, like us meeting today, like, what do I want to know about you? And I've brought that to my interactions on the podcast with guests. Like, what is that one thing? Instead of, you know, having a blank canvas where that anxiety can be overpowering or just putting all of our focus on ourselves. Like, I'm going to make a fool of myself. I'm going to be embarrassed. They're not going to like me.
Mm.
Right. Instead, just training your mind to focus on what's that one thing that I want to know about this person? And then give yourself the grace to have one conversation. So often I find clients who really struggle with social anxiety, they put way too much pressure on themselves that they have to go to the event, they have to go out with their friends, and they have to talk to everyone. And then all of a sudden that becomes a much more difficult goal to reach. And then when you don't reach it, you beat yourself up and you regress. Whereas if I know I have a networking event, if I know I have to go out and be social, I just say, I'm going to have one great conversation.
Okay.
That's the bar for me. That's the goal. Not meet 10 people, not fill my phone with numbers, just one great conversation. And what I find in that one great conversation is it naturally leads to more conversations.
Wow. You familiar with the principle Kaizen?
Yeah.
Okay. So you, of course you are. You know everything. So I think it was about 2 years ago, it was a book I read, and it was all about Kaizen and these... Well, and for anybody listening that isn't familiar with Kaizen, essentially it means just small, continuous action. If you want to get into the habit of working out, just set the goal of doing one push-up. If you want to get into, you know, oral hygiene, get your oral hygiene better, just floss one tooth. And starting there. So I think, like you said, if you're socially anxious, don't say, oh, yeah, I have to talk to everybody in this party. Just say, I have to have just one good conversation. Or maybe just say hello to one person. And the more you do that, the more exposure you're going to have, right? Exposure therapy, one of the most result-oriented types of therapy in the world. Being in the place where you're afraid of, eventually that place is no longer anything to be scared of.
Yeah, and the grace to leave. You know, I'll have one great conversation and I don't have to stay till the event's over. I don't have to stay till last hour. I don't have to stay until everyone else is leaving. I know that in those moments where my social battery as an introvert's running on empty, I'm not going to be charismatic. I'm not going to perform at my best. I'm probably not going to leave a great first impression. And knowing that first impressions are so indelible and so hard to change, I'd rather leave on a high note. I'd rather leave when I'm in a really good state than drain myself all the way down so that I'm struggling tomorrow. I can't fulfill the tasks as an introvert. So compassion. That subtle shift, right? Self-compassion and the grace to say, one conversation, I'm going to stay long enough to meet one person. And over time, as you said, through exposure therapy, you're going to look at your watch all of a sudden and be like, wow, I've been here 2 hours. How did that happen?
Talk to me about, so a lot of people know about IQ. I mean, we take IQ tests. Tell me a little bit about EQ. How important is EQ and measuring EQ for especially the younger generation coming up?
Yeah, I think touching on the previous point, I think EQ, as we're becoming more and more isolated digitally, we're going to school online, we're ordering from apps, we're going to the store and touching the screen, buying our groceries. We're diminishing our ability to work on our empathy, to work on our listening, to work on our self-awareness and our presence, right? To be mindful. And really, when you bolster those areas, you raise your EQ, you not only become more likable, but you actually foster the relationships that are going to help you get ahead, that are going to actually help you in life. Life is difficult. It's painful. Mm-hmm. It's arduous. Mm-hmm. Your relationships are ultimately what is going to bolster the quality of your life. Mm-hmm. We just had Daniel Waldinger on the show, and he is in charge of the longest running happiness study in the world, the Harvard mm-hmm. Happiness Study. Mm-hmm. And what they found over 85 plus years and mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of participants, men, women, multi-generational families that they followed along, it's the quality of positive relationships in your life hmm. that impact your health and well-being more than anything. Diet, wow. exercise, everything huh. comes back to, do you feel secure and safe in the tribe? Do you feel cared for? Do you feel heard? Do you have relationships to lean on when life gets tough, hmm. when your health takes a turn? Hmm. Or are you working to disconnect yourself from that, to isolate yourself digitally, hmm. to remove yourself from the human connection? Hmm. So investing in EQ, bolstering and growing your EQ actually has health and wellness benefits. Hmm. It helps longevity. When we look at the blue zones, as we were talking about earlier, hmm. community hmm. is key. They're constantly day in and day out relying on other people. Hmm. They're not on iPhones. They're not Zooming it. Hmm. They're walking uphill with the tribe. They're walking uphill with the community. They're being active with the community. Hmm. And in that community bonding, they live longer.
Hmm. All of these studies, I've heard this study before, and I don't know if it used or is a part of the Harvard Grant study. There's so much literature about happiness, community, well-being, EQ. But when I look at the world, it seems like we're going in the wrong direction. What can we do? I mean, I think you're doing a great job, but what can the average person do in order to really make an impact in this world and on their own communities?
I think it starts at the local level. You know, it starts with your neighbors. I live in LA, and I can tell you, coming from the Midwest, I know fewer of my neighbors here because we're walking around with AirPods, we're on our phone, we're not connecting with each other. Mm. So are you connecting with your neighbors? Are you getting involved in charity at the local level? What are you doing to support your community? Mm. And the more engaged you get with your community, the higher quality of life you're ultimately going to have. Mm. And I definitely think there are digital communities, don't get me wrong, yeah. but tapping into those digital communities and then making time for the in-person, you know, we were talking about masterminds earlier. Mm. Like, I've had virtual masterminds through the pandemic, but it's always different when I get in the room with those people, yeah. right? Mm. The depth of conversation, connection, vulnerability that opens up when we're face-to-face with one another, mm. it's a beautiful thing. Mm. So how can you find more of that in your life? If you have hobbies, passions, pursuits, how can you do it in a group setting, in a group environment? Can you join a club? Can you be more active and include social in your passions and pursuits? Mm. Now, if you think about prison, what's the absolute worst punishment in prison? It's isolation.
The hole.
Yeah, they put you in the hole. Mm. But so many of us, through our daily actions, are choosing the hole. We're grabbing our phone. We're choosing the digital. We're not reaching out to our friends and family. We're saying no to the social events because of anxiety. Mm. We're not investing in those relationships. Mm. We seemingly are investing in ourselves. And unfortunately, in a lot of those self-motivated investments, we're harming our mental health. We're harming our community.
Wow. In the sauna, you mentioned your most prized attainment, which is freedom. You love freedom. What does freedom mean to you?
Freedom is time, right? It's understanding how to leverage my time to make an impact on my health, my relationships, and my career. So I'm looking at time as being the scarcest resource in my life. You know, as I turned 40, started to realize maybe I'd neglected some of my health. Maybe I hadn't really put enough emphasis on being the best version of myself in the wellness and well-being categories, mm-hmm. looking at, okay, well, how am I using my time? We talked about drinking earlier, right? I was using my time sometimes to drink, to put myself in a situation that wasn't healthy, that wasn't mm-hmm. conducive to making the best choices for myself. Mm-hmm. So I look at time as that scarce resource. So how can I leverage my time to have the greatest impact on myself, my family, mm-hmm. and my community? Mm-hmm. So I got very fortunate in creating a podcast that allows me in that hour long conversation with the guests to share it with people who are fans of the show, to raise their impact, to grow myself, to learn you know, and have guests on that probably wouldn't give me an hour of their time just off the street, right? So time is that thing that we can all leverage, and how are we using it in our life? Freedom to me is having more choice over my time.
Mm. Freedom is having more choice over, that's it. That's it. And we chase, but we chase money. Somebody said, you know, they're printing money. Nobody's printing time.
Yeah.
Can't get it back. You said you're a meditator, and I'm just curious on your mindfulness or your meditation practice. What does that involve?
For us, it's always been something that our clients have struggled with. So we've tried to bring on various mindfulness scientists, researchers, and meditation practitioners. And I kind of got stuck on the science of 7 minutes.
Okay.
Minimum effective dose. Okay. For me, it came up again and again in some of our interviews. So I have a 7-minute meditation. That's just something that I repeat over the 7 minutes.
A mantra.
Yeah, a mantra that I worked on with a meditation coach.
Wow.
So basically through a visualization, I came upon this mantra describing what I was seeing. And it allows me to go back to that place of clarity and focus. And it's 7 minutes in my morning. And I feel that one step is the easiest for me. You know, I have friends who are going on retreats, who meditate for an hour plus a day. But that 7 minutes, I find to be my most effective dose to fit into my routine and to allow me to have the clarity and the focus and the presence that I want in my relationships, in my life, and in my career.
7 minutes. So it's a visualization practice, and you're embodying, you're feeling the feelings of success or happiness, gratitude.
It's a place that I can go to mentally. So it's not an embodiment of something per se, but it's a way for me to escape and focus and clear my mind. So my mantra in working with this meditation coach just came through visualization of getting really comfortable, really relaxed, and thinking about a joyous moment in my life. And then breaking it down into something that I could repeat over and over again that would take me back to that moment.
Awesome. Beautiful.
What's your meditation practice?
I think practice is actually probably something I need to do more of. But I think meditation practice can also become a trap. I've studied the Hindu philosophy and Advaita Vedanta, pretty much the, if you want to learn what meditation really is, this is the way to look. And what I've understood is that meditation is not something that you do. It's more something that you are. When meditation is regimented, it has benefit, but you lose something out of life. Meditation, I think, is a portal into life. This spacious awareness that exists beyond the thoughts, beyond this body. And some people can describe it as home. So I guess for me, my practice is maybe a few dozen or sometimes a few hundred times a day, just coming back to the present, the here and now, without thoughts, without judgment. But I do think there is value in having a practice. But all the great sages and, you know, even the modern sages like Eckhart Tolle says, eventually you have to drop the practice. And play the game, you know.
So
I think meditation is such a beautiful doorway and such a good tool. And if somebody is really interested in life itself, not thoughts about life, but really about living. So anyway, that's my long answer.
No, I love it. It's beautiful. I think as I look at my practice and my over-analytical scientific mind goes to like, okay, regimented, like how can I just get this in? And you almost get to that place like, well, I got my 7 minutes, I checked that box versus how do I live this in the present moment?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Meditation, some people, they meditate because, okay, they want to relax or they want to be more productive or they want to even might want to make more money. You know, it's like you're picking up pennies and stepping over dollars, right? Like the purpose is so much bigger than that.
Yeah,
it's actually beyond description. It's literally ineffable.
Thank you for sharing. That's beautiful.
Yeah, you got it. So I got a fun game I want to play with you.
Okay.
And I don't know, I call this game the best. And so I'm going to ask you a few questions, kind of rapid fire, but feel free to take your time, of the best things in your life. you're a scientist, so I'm sure you're not a fan of absolutes, but do your best.
Yeah, you were bringing up some issues for me right there with best, yeah.
Best investment you ever made?
It honestly was in public speaking.
Mm.
I avoided it until I got to graduate school, and then I was forced into it, and I struggled tremendously with all the anxiety, the sweats, the nervousness, the shaking, and I took two public speaking trainings, one of which they actually filmed me, which was the genesis of us filming our clients in our programs, and I just found that's been so impactful in my communication on the podcast, creating videos, being in front of the room. It's had such a profound impact on my career that it's really immeasurable at this point what the return on that investment is.
And what were the courses? Can you shout them out, or was it?
Yeah, so it was Dale Carnegie's High Impact Presentations was the course with the filming that really helped inspire me. And I'm blanking on the other one, but it was around storytelling and narrative.
Oh,
so how to turn your speech and your presentation into a story that people will remember versus facts, data, and overcomplicated slides.
Yeah. My sometimes my science background can get in the way too. it's like I'm the scientist, but I'm a poet too. But sometimes I try to give people too many facts.
Yeah.
Just goes over the head. Best time in your life?
Right now, right here.
It's a meditative answer right there. Love it. Best book you've ever read?
I think it's Adam Grant's Give and Take in the self-help space.
Wow. Okay, I got to pick that one up.
Because I view giving as the ultimate gift that's opened so many doors for me. And in the past, I'd struggled with people who were takers, who didn't give at all. And that book has really helped me reframe my own giving and then realize how not to take someone taking from me personally. So that's why it's been so impactful for me.
Best quote you've ever heard?
I don't know who said this quote, but I live by this legacy is greater than currency mindset. What is the impact that I'm making? Not the selfish. What am I gaining from the situation?
That's awesome. Love that. And for my final question, I ask every guest, AJ, it's the magic wand question. If you could wave a magic wand at the world, and tomorrow when you wake up, whatever your wish was granted, what would that wish be?
I think we know the answer after this interview. Investing in relationships and helping those who are struggling in building relationships, feeling isolated, feeling ostracized, feeling neglected in relationships, to reinvest in relationships in their life. As I said from the Harvard Happiness Study, those relationships have such a strong impact.
Yeah.
And growing up in a divorced household where my dad was a single dad, that relationship impacted my family so strongly. And that was really one of the impetuses for me to not only improving my dating life, but helping to find the right partner and then share so that others could follow.
Yes, relationships are the number one currency. Wealth starts with we for a reason, right? AJ, you're the man. Really appreciate you coming on Sauna Sessions. You dropped a lot of gems, a lot of jewels. Where can people find you? Where can they follow you, listen to you? And you do boot camps as well. You got all these great things. Where can people just learn more about the amazing things you have to share?
Well, thank you for having me. It was really amazing, and I got some quotes from you too, so I'm excited about that. They can find me at theartofcharm.com, and if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a fan of podcasts, and that's The Art of Charm is the name of my podcast.
Listen to that podcast, guys. You're going to learn a lot. Art of Charm podcast. AJ, thanks, man.
Thank you.